Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Donald Trump won the White House with overwhelming support from white working class voters. In Ohio, he won 52% at the polls on Tuesday, landing him an important 18 electoral votes that helped position him for victory. Coming up, we're going to take a closer look at that white populist voter who turned out in droves to tip the scales for Trump. Joining us now to talk about who voted and how in Ohio is creator of OhioElectionResults.com, Mike Dawson. Welcome back, Mike.
Thank you. Nice to be back.
The Trump victory wasn't necessarily out of lines with the polls. The final tally fell within the margins of error on most polls, but it tipped the scale, you know, but it surprised people nonetheless. So what tipped the scales in Ohio?
Well, clearly the white, particularly men, vote. He just won that by astounding margins. And if you look at the Ohio map and compare it to 2012, along the east and southeast half of the state, those counties are as red can be. He won 30 counties with 70% or more of the vote. Romney won 6. I mean, it's just – those numbers are just astounding.
It's not unprecedented.
The margins are pretty high. I mean, for example, in southeast Ohio, he got 66% of the vote, the second highest in Ohio history. Hoover got 69% in 1928. The average in southeast Ohio in recent elections is around 51, 52. So in those areas of the state, I mean, he won the Youngstown media market, which hasn't been done since the Nixon landslide in 72 for a Republican. So in those economically depressed areas and up the western half of the state, he exceeded totals by almost record margins.
Which means every voter in every county outside the big cities voted for him. They went out to vote, for starters.
Yeah. She just didn't connect with any – I mean, he got more Democratic votes than she got Republican votes. The conventional wisdom was that that was going to be the reverse. And she had a real problem with her base. They just never were enthusiastic about her. Mm-hmm. And his base was obviously very enthusiastic about him.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're crunching the numbers now. In the 2016 Ohio presidential election results, obviously Trump took Ohio and all of its electoral votes. But pundits are saying over the last couple of days that Donald Trump blew up the map when it comes to politics in the United States. With me here in the studio right now is Mike Dawson. He's creator of OhioElectionResults.com. This is what he does, is look at this kind of data. If you have a question or comment about the numbers, the voting numbers in Ohio post 2016 election, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So when something like this happens, it could be a one-time deal. It doesn't mean — they say he blew up the map, but the pieces could be put back together again in 4 years.
Yeah, he was a unique candidate.
Yeah.
You're never going to see a candidate like this again, I don't think, not in our lifetimes. Mm-hmm. And so for the next election, this map might look the same, but it'll settle back into a more normal looking map when he's not. I mean, he's just such a unique candidate and got, you know, unique votes. I mean, he got his percentage. He won union households by the same percentage of the voters he won non-union households.
And how could pollsters predict that?
Well, pollsters are supposed to know what sample they're picking.
So,
they're surveying those people. And, you know, the results on Election Day were different. I mean, the Dispatch poll, which is the most reliable poll in the state of Ohio, had her up 1.
Yeah.
He won by 8.5.
Right.
So my guess is that Trump voters didn't fill out the Dispatch poll. And he was like, you know, that's silly. And so the poll didn't pick up the intensity of the Trump vote.
And maybe they were whoever's out there underestimated the reliability of a Trump voter. So you're looking for that likely voter. A lot of these people, a lot of them hadn't voted in a while, hadn't voted, some of them were first-time voters.
Yeah.
And they were young.
we're essentially, when the provisional ballots are counted, which are there's about 157,000 of those that are outstanding, and then there'll be some additional absentee by mail ballots that come in. When we count all those ballots, the turnout in 2016 is going to be fairly close to 2012. So the Obama won by 166,000 votes, and he won by 450. So obviously, he either brought Democrats into the fold, and he just increased the intensity amongst Republicans. Republicans were coming home at the end to Trump. Mm-hmm. People who had held out, the so-called Kasich holdout voters, they all came home rushing in the last week, 10 days.
Chuck in Grandview Heights, you're on the air. Hi, Chuck.
Hi.
Chuck, could you pull the phone away from your mouth, please?
Oh, sure. Sure, sure. Can you hear me okay now?
Yeah, farther away you pull it, the better.
Okay, sorry. My question is, I've seen some numbers on a national scale about the number of eligible voters versus the number of people that actually did come out and cast a ballot. Can you talk to how those numbers flesh out for Ohio? How many people in Ohio were eligible to vote? How many actually did? And how many voted for, you know, Donald Trump versus Hillary Clinton?
Okay. I think we know that. All right. Thank you, Chuck.
I haven't looked at the eligible voter numbers, but I can tell you amongst registered voters in 2012, it was about 70% of registered voters, and it's going to be about the same in 2016. I just haven't looked at the eligible voter.
So pretty
numbers.
Decent voter turnout. Chuck, thanks a lot for that. But but different bases were enthusiastic this time.
Yeah, big swing of votes, like over 600,000 votes swung from the last election to this election. And, you know, Ohio has been a pretty purple state in recent presidential elections. Prior to this election, in the previous 10, the Democrats have won 5, the Republicans have won 5, just the same as nationally. So this is now tilted towards the Republican favorite. In off-presidential years, Ohio is a deeply red state. Democrats just don't come out in off-presidential years. So in 2018, in the governor's race and all the other statewide races, most people say, well, that's going to hurt Republicans because Trump is president and they won't do as well in the off years. But if the state has become that much more red, that may not be the case.
Trumbull County went from being deeply Democratic in 2012 to being bright red, not dark red, but bright red in 2016. Again, that's that far northwest corner of the state that where times are hard.
Yeah, and Ashtabula County flipped. Columbiana County was slightly more Republican. And as you said, Trumbull flipped. So all the way up to the top of the state, all the way down the southeast and over into the southwest, those Ohio River counties just got more red and less blue.
I read one analyst who said that African-American voters supported Hillary Clinton at almost the same levels as Obama, but that the intensity wasn't enough. So what's the distinction between supporting and intensity?
Well,
is that the magic in turning up?
Yeah, I think that's true. I think she got about the same percentage points, but I don't think they turned out in the same numbers. We'll
okay.
see.
So the larger raw number wasn't.
We'll see.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not sure of that yet, but you know, it's about 14% of the Ohio vote is African American. So.
Chris in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Chris.
Hi, Sam. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I had a question more about the third party vote. I voted third party, and right now we're all being blamed, saying we had a Nader-like effect on this election. So I guess assuming that all these votes would go to Clinton, even though she didn't really earn them, do you think that the outcome would have been different had it only been just the two, or
that? All the polling is showing that Johnson took about equal number of votes away from Clinton and Trump. In fact, some people suggest that if you look at the county by county numbers, that he took more from Trump than he did from Clinton. So I'm just not sure that's true. I those voters weren't going to go all to Clinton by any stretch of the imagination.
Yeah, it's only anecdotal, but we had a Bernie Sanders supporter call in the last hour who said he voted for Trump. So there's no guarantees on that. Chris, thanks a lot for that call. Brandon in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Brandon.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thank you.
So it's more of a comment than a question, but I think that people, you know, in general, we really lost sight of the fact that Trump is kind of a party of his own. We keep talking GOP and Democrats, and I think, again, the whole premise of his candidacy was if he could have started his very own party, the Donald Trump Party, he would have if he didn't rely so much on the RNC, you know, the ground game and stuff like that. But, you know, I think, you know, to go back to analyzing this on a Democrat versus Republican, you know, groundwork, I just don't think that we can do that. It's like in poker, things change completely when the professional poker players started not being able to follow what the computers were doing, essentially. So I think we're talking about a whole new ballgame here. I think trying to analyze it in the classic senses that we're trying to, it just doesn't make sense. It doesn't work. It doesn't fit into that architecture. So I think, whether it's going to be a blip on the map, whether this is a Trump thing or whether this is going to be a whole new ballgame for the way that politics is played, I just don't think that people are as much diehard blue or diehard red as they used to be. They just want either the change or they want the continuation of the establishment.
Okay. Brandon, thanks a lot for that call.
So one of the other things you have to look at when you look at what kind of voters turned out, Trump got 110,000 more votes than Romney did. She got 510,000 fewer votes than Obama did. So Trump did well, but she did very, very poorly.
Right. She did very, very poorly. Yeah. And there's not a lot of focus on that. It's kind of hard to understand when we contrast and compare what happened with what the pollsters said was going to happen.
So outside of those really Republican counties that you saw in the eastern and southeastern part of the state.
Yeah, the usuals,
One of the other things that happened is Romney lost Northeast Ohio by 15 percentage points. He lost it by less than 1%. So the same type of voters, people who have been disaffected, people who have lost their jobs in that Northeast Ohio regions, in those areas like Parma and Brook Park and all those other things, he really cut the margins up there. I mean, a 15-point swing in Northeast Ohio is unbelievable.
Any sense about whether this was a gender-related issue? Talk about, like, what kind of margin she did with women.
Yeah. So he won males 57-37, but she only won women 51-46. Everybody expected that he was going to do really well with males, particularly white males.
Uh-huh.
But people thought that she would do better amongst women. 5 points just wasn't enough, even though females make up 53% of the Ohio electorate and males only make up 47. It just wasn't enough votes. She needed to win 55-42 in order to carry off the state.
And did that differ from county to county, or is it where it went really dark blue and blue?
Well, we don't collect statistics that way.
Okay.
If so, it's hard to tell. This poll, what the numbers I just cited to you are from exit polls, and they don't release county by county data.
What do you want to know more about at this point, someone who analyzes this stuff every day?
Well, the more time you have to look at it, the more interesting it is. I've done a lot of interviews and a lot of other things for other people.
Yeah.
And I can't wait to look at the data. At some point, I'll stop though until we get the provisional ballots, because you're not comparing apples to apples. Like mm-hmm. I said, there's going to be 157,000 more votes, so she's going to pick up votes. He's going to pick up votes. The numbers aren't going to be the same. So these differences between Romney and Trump and Obama and Clinton are going to change when those votes get counted.
They're saying that she got the popular vote. She didn't get the popular vote in Ohio.
No.
She got the popular vote around the country.
Right. Yeah, because she won big in places like California and New York.
So no surprises there. Okay. Mike Dawson, thanks for joining us today. Appreciate your time.
Happy to be with you. Thanks.
Mike Dawson, creator of OhioElectionResults.com. Coming up, we're going to talk about that rise of white populism. Certainly was a factor in what happened in Ohio on Election Day. Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org to get your thoughts in there. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We just heard from the creator of OhioElectionResults.com on how Ohio voted in the 2016 election, at least what we know so far. It will still take weeks to parse through all the voter behavior in Donald Trump's victory, but one factor at the core of his success is a new strain of American populism. We're talking about the growing movement of populism and how it will play out in the future of American politics. Joining us is political science professor at Denison University, Heather Poole. Welcome to the show, Heather.
Thank you very much. I'm happy to be here.
Also by phone, assistant professor of presidential studies at the University of Virginia, Miller Center of Public Affairs, Nicole Hemmer. She's the author of a new book. It's entitled Messengers of the Right, Conservative Media and the Transformation of American Politics. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
The term populist, let's first talk about that and what we mean by it. It's been used to describe a wide range of politicians from Hugo Chavez to Donald Trump. What do we mean by populism? Nicole Hemmer?
So I think that the way that it's been used in the United States is not just to describe a leader or a movement that claims to be speaking for the people, but has this sort of map of the politics that points out an establishment, an elite that has taken power from the people, and sometimes that elite is partnered with African Americans and minorities and people who don't have a lot of power, who are then uplifted by that elite at the cost of the power of the people. And that's been the way that it's been construed for about 150 years here in the United States.
So this isn't new then, right, Heather Poole?
It is not new at all. In fact, I was just thinking about Jackson's election, actually, in the early middle part of the 19th century. And in fact, one of the ways that the American populist movement, certainly in terms of whiteness, started or was continued was that whites were poor, and there was a way in which they could ally with other poor people, or they could ally with rich white people. And what ends up happening with the westward expansion and with the expansion of the franchise in the 1820s is that, in fact, whites get captured into whiteness as opposed to into sort of class antagonisms, which, of course, is what
economic
as opposed to they don't choose economic bonds. They choose racial bonds.
So do people who are populists, Nicole Hemmer, when you're talking about what the media is reaching, do the consumers out there, do they see themselves as populists?
Oh, I think so. And I think that part of what we're seeing now is a change in the media that has allowed this populist idea to return front and center. And that is sort of both the fragmentation of the media landscape and its new interactivity. People feel like they have, and they do have, much more power when it comes to expressing themselves, when it comes to being able to interact with leaders, whether it's on Twitter or on Facebook or on websites. They feel they have more of a voice. And so there have been that sort of populist voice has been captured by sites like Breitbart News, which has become the site of right-wing populism and defines itself as populist rather than conservative. And I think that language change is really important for understanding how populists see themselves as something distinct from what we would have talked about 10 to 20 years ago as conservatism.
But do populists, I mean, are they always right-wing populists?
Not at all. In the late 19th century, the populist movement. I think that you could call it right wing in terms of its racial politics, but you know, it's economic liberalism. It's calling for protectionism, for power for the working class, as Heather mentioned, the white working class generally, calling in the late 19th century for more federal government intervention into the economy in order to provide support against corporations.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the rise of the white populist movement in the United States. Proof is in the pudding, I guess. It had a lot to do with the victory at the polls for Donald Trump on Election Day. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You just heard from Nicole Hemmer. She's author of a new book. It's entitled Messengers of the Right, Conservative Media and the Transformation of American Politics. She's also an assistant professor at the University of Virginia Miller Center of Public Affairs. And with me in the studio, Heather Poole, a political science professor at Denison University. Bryant in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Bryant.
Hello. Greatly enjoy your show.
Thank you.
I'm a poll worker. I worked for the primary, and I also worked this last election. One thing I think that media, as far as everybody being kind of like blindsided, the media would say one thing. I think, from my observation, I think a lot of things that caused some problems was the way the media was covering the primary, especially the Democratic primary. There was people pretty upset about what was going on and how the coverage was taking place with Sanders and Hillary Clinton. Then when there was a problem with the DNC, and accusations that there was some fraud going out, like in California and some other voting precincts. Then on social media, I observed where there were some people that were so Democrats that were so ticked off that there was no way that they were going to vote for Hillary. And there was even a hashtag on social media called Never Hillary. I'm wondering if possibly if that's what happened, where the Sanders rallies weren't really being covered very well, even though he was outperforming Hillary.
I mean, but you're wondering if there, what impact, if, in other words, if there's a left-wing populism at play here as well, because obviously Bernie Sanders is a socialist. I mean, he's obviously left of center. Heather Poole, what about that? Is there a distinction here to be made between the white wing and the left-wing populism? And Bryant, thank you.
Well, there certainly is a strain of liberalism that is we tend to think of liberalism, we tend to think of it as a unifying thing where we are all individuals, we are all equal before the law. But as several recent books have shown, the way that the law is written and conceived of doesn't necessarily play out in practice as a equalizing force. So one author talks about whiteness as a form of property, wherein you can, for example, be charged with libel for calling someone black if they're white, but not calling someone black if they're black. And so, in terms of whether or not populism can be left wing, part of the issue in the United States is that the spectrum of politics is quite narrow. We've narrowed it to the ground of small liberalism, and so that sees everyone as individuals. And I think there are certainly ways in which left wing populism and right wing populism can sort of wrap around and share an awful lot of DNA. Right?
Yeah, yeah. What do you think, Nicole Hemmer? Because you focus a lot on right wing media, conservative media, but he grabbed a lot of these disaffected Bernie Sanders supporters.
Right. I think that there are two things going on here. One, in the question, you can hear a populist argument about a media elite, right? That they're being unfair, that they're sort of quashing the voice of the people. That's populist language. I think it's fair to call that left-wing populism. What's interesting here is that there's a bit of a disconnect. I mean, if you look at in 2015, the media coverage in the primary, both Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders received a great deal of favorable and neutral coverage, and actually less negative coverage than Hillary Clinton did. And that has to do with how races are covered. But I think it's important to separate the rhetoric, which is, you know, the media aren't paying attention to us, the media are covering us negatively, from what media analysts have looked at, which is that show that that's not necessarily the case, but that perception is incredibly important. And I think that the framing of the question shows that populist opposition to this idea of an elite who are keeping your voice from being heard.
Because the actually, if you count the quotes, if you count the coverage, that doesn't bear out.
Right, especially because, you know, Hillary Clinton had with her at the beginning of 2015 an air of inevitability. Mm-hmm. And so when Sanders was gaining on her, he was getting a lot of favorable coverage because he was doing better than expected. And she was getting a lot of negative coverage because she was doing worse than expected.
Ross in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Ross. Hello, Ross. Okay, we'll double check on Ross. Joe in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hi. I'm just bringing up a point that I haven't seen brought up much, and that is, you know, I voted for Trump as a last act of defiance because I'm tired of all the normal that goes on. So when all of us that voted for Trump go out there and do that, well, all the polls were showing Hillary winning. So a lot of her electorate decided that, well, it's already won. There's no point in me going. So she ended up losing for lack of voting.
Well, they didn't show her winning by as much as it would make anyone feel comfortable. But you said why you voted for Donald Trump is because you're just sick of the status quo.
Exactly.
Okay.
You know, the true definition of insanity is to do the same thing over and over and expect different results.
Okay, that's interesting. So populists have a sage streak in them, and he makes a good point. But is that pretty typical, Heather Poole?
So one of the interesting things, and I teach political theory, it's kind of the history of political thought. The Greek conception of politics was very much where we get the word republic once it makes its way to Rome. And the base of that is the thing which is common. By the time we get to Locke, who's the sort of founder of early liberalism, politics becomes the way – it's a necessary evil. It's a thing that we have to do to protect our property and to protect our rights. And so I think the caller's point, which is that politics – is not seen as a sort of worthwhile endeavor that is collective and shared power, but as a thing that stands in the way of freedom. I think that's very much a sort of legacy of liberalism. And as someone who studies political theory and in fact thinks that politics is the only thing that brings us together in a country that's filled with immigrants, that doesn't have a state church, that on some level says that it values diversity, that politics is the only place where we can actually bridge those differences. And if we think of politics as something dirty, as something that is not helpful and not necessary, then I think that really shuts down our ability to sort of work together, even when we have differences at the margins.
Nicole Hemmer, what does your research say about the influence of the conservative media on people like our last caller who just wants to, you know, wants to just change?
So ever since the 1940s and 50s, one of the sort of primary aspects of conservative media has been this oppositional identity, this idea that conservatives have been excluded, that they're outsiders, that they need to take over the establishment in order to have their voices heard because they felt excluded from the parties, they felt excluded from the media. And so you hear the populism in that sense of exclusion and that need to take on the establishment. Now, in the 40s and 50s and into the 80s, taking on the establishment, you were hoping to replace the establishment. And in many ways, conservatives did. Through the Reagan era, through the Bush era, conservatives not only won control of government, but they built their own media. What's happening now is a new strain of populism that is not only opposed to those liberal establishments, but is opposed as well to the Republican establishment, to the conservative establishment, and perhaps to all establishments. So it'll be interesting to see to what extent this populism continues to be anti-establishment, even as Republicans control power in Washington and Donald Trump has become the president. He now is the establishment. So what happens
right.
next
Well, E.J. Dion wrote an interesting book last spring talking about the how the Republican Party found its way to a Donald Trump, disappointment after disappointment, failure to fulfill promises after failure to fulfill promises year after year after year, decade after decade. And now the question is, how much does a lot of this support for Donald Trump hinge on his, I mean, are white populists, or even take the race out of it, are populists in general, are they expecting some results, or do they feel just a sense of satisfaction that they beat the system as it is and got someone like Donald Trump elected? Heather Poole?
I think that's a great question. And in Nicole's discussion or answer to that question, I think there's something about institutions here, which is there's a very libertarian strain in American politics, a sense that if the government just got out of our way, we could succeed. And I think in some ways the populism that we're seeing is really a response to the kind of explosion of the federal government that we get after the New Deal. And the issue there is that the institutions that we have that enable roads and phones and utilities and all of those things, those are institutions too, right? It's not just affirmative action. It's not just, suing people in court, but it's also that infrastructure that is necessary to human flourishing.
We need our sewers, right?
Exactly. Yeah. And those things are a part of what government does. That is what is common to all of us. And how is it that we protect a certain kind of private individual liberty while also having everyone have access to those public goods?
We're going to continue our conversation about populism, its impact on the election this time around, significant to say the least. Questions or comments, 614-292-8513. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about the rise of populism in American politics. Still with us is Professor of Presidential Studies at the University of Virginia Miller Center of Public Affairs and author of a new book entitled Messengers of the Right, Conservative Media and the Transformation of American Politics, Nicole Hemmer. Nicole, thanks again for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us, political science professor at Denison University, Heather Poole. Thanks again for joining us.
My pleasure.
Where does the white populism stem? Well, I guess you kind of talked about that, though, at the very beginning, Heather Poole, that it was a way to differentiate people from each other by race instead of by economic resources.
Yes. And one of the things that is really, I think, underrealized about massive government interventions like the New Deal is that, in fact, who they benefited the most is whites. Whites were the ones who, coming back from their service in World War II, were able to use home loans provided by the federal government. It was white soldiers returning who were able to get GI benefits. And so, in fact, the most massive infusion of affirmative action into the United States, into the citizenry of the United States, came as a result of the New Deal, and who it benefited the most is whites.
Now, the majority.
Of course, that's exactly right. And so, of course, most of us don't think of that as a kind of affirmative action, but in fact, Ira Katznelson calls it when affirmative action was white. That's really essentially what the New Deal is. And one of the things that's really fascinating is the ways in which, as soon as those benefits started to be expanded to those who had previously been excluded, that's when we start to get the massive backlash. That's when we start to get the anti-busing, the response to Brown v. Board, massive resistance in the South, et cetera.
And with a little nudging by the conservative media, Nicole Hemmer?
Well, that's absolutely right. And I think just to build on Heather's point, that when we see populism in the late 19th century and most of the first half of the 20th century, it's calling for more government intervention. And so support for the progressive movement, support for the New Deal. It's not just that the federal government begins to expand those benefits to people of color, but also the federal government is called back in to protect black civil rights in the mid-1960s. And when that happens, you see a backlash against the federal government and a call for the government to get smaller and smaller. And so part of it is getting the federal government not just to stop distributing goods to people of color, but also to stop protecting their civil rights. I mean, this is something that we've seen in terms of the withdrawal of the government from protecting voting rights. And so smaller government, that call has with it now a racial dimension.
But a self-identified populist who happens to be white wouldn't necessarily think that about themselves, would they?
No, they wouldn't necessarily think that about themselves. In fact, I think that they would argue pretty strongly against that idea. But what we see, if not an active racism, it is an indifference to the role that the federal government plays in protecting the individual rights of people of color. And that indifference is racism as well. But it's also a conversation that we haven't been able to have for the last 10 to 20 years because there has been a real reticence to talk about racism and to talk about its influence on politics.
RJ in Westerville, you wanted to talk about this yourself. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Listen, I'm just curious. We keep perpetuating black, white in the media. I mean, you chop the black, white, male, female, blah, 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 up. And I'm like, why don't you say Indian or Korean or German? It's always black, white. And it's like Morgan Freeman said, I'm not a black man. I'm a man. Put me in a box, basically, is what he's saying. There comes a point where we need to move on. It's like civil rights was in 64. And both you keep chopping and putting everybody in boxes and doing all this other stuff. It's just ridiculous. Mm.
Nicole Hemmer?
Well, we can pretend that race doesn't exist, but the way that goods are distributed in society, the protection that people have for their voting rights, the ways that they're treated by the police, the way that they're treated by society are conditioned by race. Morgan Freeman may not want to be seen as a black man, but when he walks down the street, that is how he is treated. And so to ignore that as a lived reality and to ignore the different experiences that people have because of how society treats people of different races, I think is to not address an issue that requires addressing.
And I would echo what Nicole said. One of the things that's really fascinating about studying the creation of these categories, and I think that's really what the caller is asking about, and I think that's a great question, is that 100 years ago, there was no widely understood meaning of what white was. In fact, the term was Anglo-Saxon. That was the dominant understanding of what it meant to be at the top of the racial pyramid. And in fact, there's, you know, incredible racial science that starts in the 1880s and really doesn't end until the rise of Germany before World War II, that there is a hierarchy of races. There are Anglo-Saxons at the top, and then at the very bottom, at the other end of that spectrum, are people from Africa. And so within that, there's a lot of gradations. So if you were Italian 100 years ago, you were not seen as a white person. You were seen as a not quite white, as the literature calls it. The fascinating thing is I think as the caller points out and is frustrated with, is that all of those spectrums within whiteness, all of those different sort of categories have become consolidated into one big whiteness. But if your last name was McGuire, or if your last name was an Italian surname, 100 years ago, you would not have been seen as a white person and would not have received as much privilege from that as you would have now.
Carmen in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Carmen.
Hi there. I'm glad to come into the conversation at this point because my question and comment really are about this looming problem of systemic racism that clouds this election so much of American politics. In particular, I'm curious about why there's so little, I mean, I would even venture to say no conversation about the convict and ex-convict population in this country, over 6 million people, most of them non-white, who are not able to vote, you know, even if they have served their time, you know, as mm-hmm. as the saying goes. I'm sort of shocked, first of all, at this lack of civil liberties, but then at the larger silence around them, the fact that this never seems to come up in the media. I mean, we talk a lot about sort of who can vote, who goes to vote and who doesn't go to vote, but not at all about who isn't allowed to vote and the sort of systematic disenfranchisement of that, again, non-white population.
Well, Carmen, I mean, I want to hear what the experts say, but I will say NPR did a really good story exactly on that issue last week. So I would refer you to NPR. Check it out. Of course, you know, that's a shot, you know, drop in the bucket. No question about it. I think your point, your larger point, is very correct. We have, you know, there's some great sociologists out there who have done lots of work on the school to prison pipeline and that kind of a thing. But Heather Poole, I mean, there is a huge part of our population, particularly our minority population, that it's imprisoned in this country. They're not allowed to vote.
Absolutely. And one of the fascinating things is, you know, I think Carmen's question is a really interesting one. The caller right before said civil rights was in the 60s. Why are we still talking about this in terms of race? One of the things that's really fascinating in the sort of evolution of felon disenfranchisement is that the people who are most arguing for segregation now, segregation forever, within about 5 years switched to the war on drugs. So it went from white people and black people should not live in the same place in the South or really anywhere else to drugs are a scourge. They must be purged from our communities. And we ramped up the punishment for every term at the end of representative terms in the House of Representation. This is Naomi Murakawa's work. People would stand on the floor of the House of Representatives and say, I don't think this is going to make society better, but I have to vote to increase this mandatory minimum so that I can keep my seat. And so the sort of segregationist logic transferred immediately onto the war on drugs. And as a result of that, we have massive felon disenfranchisement, which has fallen most heavily on people of color.
Mm-hmm. Anything to add, Heather? Nicole Hammer?
Well, so Michelle Alexander has written about this
exactly.
As the new Jim Crow, and I think that work has begun to focus people's attention on the racial dimensions of disenfranchisement. And then I think adding that together with the new legislation that's come out in the past 3 years since the Supreme Court took away part of the Voting Rights Act. Here, Ari Berman's book, Give Us the Ballot, is great at charting the way that African Americans have been disenfranchised through stricter voting laws. I think it's important to take those two things together. And when you take those two things together, you have an interesting story that I do think goes back to the last caller's call as well. Jamel Bowie, who's the senior political correspondent for Slate, has started to talk about this period as the second redemption. So if the second reconstruction, this reconstruction was the period after the Civil War when African Americans who were newly freed were given their civil rights and their voting rights, and the federal government protected those rights for about 10 years. And then at the end of that 10 years, you had something called redemption, which is when the white power structure was reasserted and Jim Crow was put into place. If the passage of the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act in the 1960s represented the second Reconstruction, when the federal government again came in and protected African American civil rights and voting rights, Jamel argues that what we're in now is the second redemption, when that white power structure is reasserting itself. And I think you see that both in incarceration and in this new wave of disenfranchisement. And I think it's key to understanding what's happening in our politics right now.
Email from Richard says, a shattered peasant society will look to a demagogue for salvation from what is perceived as a hopeless situation. Populism is a direct result of the elite's globalist, neoliberal, capitalist agenda. It is a natural trajectory. Authoritarianism clothed as populism is seen as a way out. Nicole Hemmer, I mean, is populism necessarily associated with authoritarianism? And do populists necessarily have more of an affinity to be told what to do?
That's a great question. I'm not sure that I would say there's a one-to-one direction mm-hmm. there, that all populists are attracted to authoritarians. I don't think that's what we've necessarily seen throughout history. But because there is a sort of conspiratorial edge that goes alongside populism, you know, that there is this elite that is keeping you from your rightful claim to power, it can shade over into, if not authoritarianism, then demagoguery, right? It's easy for a demagogue to take that fear and translate it into conspiracy, and then from there to present a single-person solution or, you know, we need to shake this entire system up and I alone can do it. I think that that's a connection. But I'd be interested in what Heather thinks about it.
I think that's a great, great point, Nicole. One of the things that I really enjoy about teaching the history of political thought is we have 2,500 years of collected wisdom in the West about how people and politics intersect. And at the very start of that is Plato in the Republic. In Book 9, he lays out the beginning, you know, it goes from the aristocracy, which is what he spent the previous 8 books talking about, and it ends in tyranny. And the next thing before tyranny is democracy. And what he calls it is a love of freedom that leads to a lack of discipline. And that's a whole other story. But because American society is so focused on freedom, and again, as I said earlier, it's kind of freedom from government rather than freedom to participate in government, that freedom is very susceptible to a strong man who says, I will protect your freedom from those who are threatening it. And so I think there is, and of course, I was just looking up Federalist 10. This is exactly what Madison is trying to sort of argue, that the Constitution can accomplish this sort of management of factions by pitting them against one another. We can't get rid of this drive to faction, but we can manage it. And that's what he thinks that the Constitution is going to do. But I think even the early founders and everybody in the history of political thought recognizes that it's very easy for a focus on freedom as the most important thing to slide into the absolute gutting of that freedom through the rise of a tyrant.
David in Worthington, you're on the air. Hi, David.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Whether we live free or die, I think it's objectively, numerically, statistically obvious that the media and the selection of stories made Trump, kept him alive, and now elected him because they gave him a lot of positive free publicity to begin with, and then very little negative publicity here at the end. For example, all of his civil suits, criminal suits, we had some other criticisms, mm-hmm. but they were very statistically small. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, David. So is there a tendency in the media, Nicole Hemmer, to not dissect a character like Donald Trump as carefully as you would, say, someone like Hillary Clinton, who's got three solid decades of public policy experience under her belt?
Well, what's so interesting about the role of the media in this election is complex and needs to be explored in a lot of different ways.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that one of the interesting things is it seems like this, because Donald Trump was so scandal-driven, the media did dissect in detail all of these different scandals that have ridden throughout his life. And they also pretty much only focused on Hillary Clinton through the lens of scandal as well. And I don't know if it's because they didn't think people would want to read about policy, because she certainly has this long storied career. She had a lot of clear policies that were not necessarily countered by the same policy depth on the other side.
Mm-hmm.
Or if it was about profit. I mean, that's the other thing about the media in this election. I think they were making a ton of money. They did make a ton of money. Les Moonves from CBS back in February said it may not be good for America, but it's darn good for CBS.
Huh.
And really encouraged Donald Trump to keep at it because they were making record profits. CNN will have made $1 billion off of this election year, and that can't be taken out of this story. It may not have been what the press wanted in terms of the outcome. And I think that that's the other side of the story, which is that the press was seen as being arrayed against Donald Trump.
Uh-huh.
But certainly they made a lot of money off of it.
Final thoughts, Heather Poole?
I think Nicole's point is really great. Political science communication literature has shown that the sort of horse race aspects of politics are ways to drive traffic to your websites or ways to get people to buy your paper. And oftentimes that comes at the cost of a substantive discussion of the actual issues. And so we come to see it as a sort of game show as opposed to the most important thing that determines the possibility of living a good life. And of course, that's up to us as citizens to demand more. And that's what I would encourage all of you to do, is when you see these things, call them out as being horse race aspects instead of substantive real discussions.
Heather Poole, political science professor at Denison University. Thanks for joining us today. Also, Nicole Hemmer, author of Messengers on the Right, Conservative Media and the Transformation of American Politics, from the University of Virginia. Thanks to you as well.
Thank you.
Thanks to the AllSides staff, producer Michael DeBonis, assistant producer Shia Lanat, AllSides interns Walter Hopp, Jessica Shakespeare, and Shelby Powers. Video production by Rich Karsminsky and Amber Karsminsky. Tough week. Thanks for all your help.